Alrighty, welcome back to episode 26 now. You know, hit the quarter of 100 mark, blazing on past. And the winner should have been a podcast you all know and love, our adoring fans who tune in every 2 weeks to hear us ramble on about movies we love, movies we hate, movies that should have won and movies that didn't. My name is Mark. I'm here with my co-host, Bob.
Hello, everyone.
And we got a special one this week. I don't think we've done a single actor expose at this point. We've done director exposés. We haven't dived into just a single actor's movies. Is that correct, or am I just totally off?
No, I don't think we've done one like this. Yeah, we did individual films. We did directors where we each took a director, but not an actor, no.
Yeah, so we're branching out here. We didn't go in an obvious direction, I think, with this pick. I can't actually remember like how exactly we landed on picking Paul Giamatti to do this episode on, because it's not like the first actor that's going to come to people's mind, but an actor I really enjoy, and I think an interesting one to do an episode about.
Yeah, I think he is. He's an interesting guy. His path through film and media, I guess, generally, because it's movies, TV, he's probably been on stage, though I know a little about that, is not what I would say is typical of a movie star or a big name actor, but he's kind of become that or built himself into that to a degree, despite a number of seeming disadvantages. So an interesting path through film and interesting actor.
Yeah. Do you feel more you know, well-educated to talk about his early career and kind of the progression there, or should I take a shot at that?
Well, I think we can go either way. I mean, we're both going to end up talking a bit about this. I made some notes, somewhat cursory. I split his work that I was able to get from IMDb. I freely admit, most of the stuff I've gotten, other than my own experience watching his films, is from IMDb. I split it between the movies and television. And I think that there's some interesting things about the way that works. He hasn't done a lot of television.
Yeah.
He's focused on film and been able to focus on film. But I'm interested to hear what you want to say. So I'm going to let you go ahead and talk about it since you offered me a choice. I'm just going to push it right back at you.
It's probably going to sound like I'm reading from a Wikipedia article, which I am bringing up to support myself here. Because like anyone who's gone through school, I know where to find information. My understanding about Paul Giamatti, of my also cursory kind of note-taking and research here, is that he started off as a supporting actor, which almost all actors, actresses do. But, you know, really sort of that was his bread and butter for a while and has been the bread and butter of his career. But I think the first one was Private Parts, which is a Howard Stern film in like 1997. From there, and this was the first time I was actually exposed to Paul Giamatti, he starred in films like Saving Private Ryan as a, you know, very brief supporting character role as an army sergeant, I believe, a couple days into D-Day in that movie. He was in a kids movie, which my wife wanted to watch with me as I prepared for this podcast, Big Fat Liar, where he's the villain of that movie. Still another supporting role, but him as a comedic villain. And then from there, he got his break, I think, in the early 2000s with some big films. Well, you could relatively say big films compared to what he was doing before. So like American Splendor, where he was the lead actor, Win-Win, Sideways, which we talked about on our last podcast, films that started to define what is like a Paul Giamatti movie. And then from there, more supporting actor roles and, as you kind of hinted at, more kind of television appearances in more recent years.
Yeah, I would say, and I think this is part of why we eventually landed on it. We were already talking about this film and the things surrounding it was Sideways.
Yeah.
Where he played the lead and it received a lot of critical notice, even if it didn't do, you know, billions at the box office. It was noticed by people that paid attention to his acting ability, and it was recognized that caused him kind of to vault into another tier. Now, he doesn't lead a lot of films still.
No.
But instead of being, I was looking at his list of credits, and I was noticing there was a couple different breaks and kind of things. So there's the big one was Sideways, where he goes from being relatively unknown. But there's a period before that as well, where if we go back to, I would say, probably the late 90s, he goes from having credits that are things like Bellman in My Best Friend's Wedding or Hotel Clerk in The Break to getting names. He starts getting names. He's Sergeant Hill in Saving Private Ryan. He's in The Negotiator. He's Rudy. He gets to be called. So he's moved from being a supporting actor of a very minor type and almost a cut above an extra. He's got lines. But we don't have to bother to tell you his name. To getting names and having a bigger role, to then Sideways, where it shows that he can actually act really well. He's capable of carrying a film, at least in tandem with other people. And then from there, even if he's not top billed, he's a one of the names that gets put on the screen by itself. He's not waiting for the crawl at the end of the film. He's before the film, getting the initial credits. Maybe he's the fourth one mentioned, but he's consistently getting that kind of work. And Yeah,
100%. I guess that is probably what people would consider the first big break, right? Is having a name, not just being listed as body in room corner four. But actually having a character. That's funny.
I mean, this is a thing that a lot of people that watch movies more than just with a, you know, the very cursory passing interest do, is that you look at those credits and you have fun with things like, I watched 10 Things I Hate About You with my kids, with my daughters, my older kids, a couple nights ago. And I was looking at the credits and I was noticing that there were a couple people that one was credited as Jock, right? So he's the high school jock. But there was another one who was, I'm guessing, a cut above. He was the pretty jock. And so...
So that's the difference in how they were listed?
That's the difference in how they were listed. So there was just the average-looking jock. Just, you know, kind of...
I love how that so accurately, you know, reveals the intent of the filmmaker there.
It does. It does. Yeah. And it's fun to find those things, you know, with those strange credits. Because they don't give characters a name and you just have to have a way to refer to them. And you're going to... Maybe they say one line or, you know, they react to something one of the main characters says. And it's got to be a real kind of mark of success on the acting ladder when you go from that to actually needing to have a name, to have someone in the film address you by name, being as much a part of the plot as that, getting enough lines that your name matters.
And like these IMDb credits are feasibly like they're from the formally submitted credits from the movies too, right? So that's what they called it.
So I mean, that's kind of what he has. I mean, he's... mentioned Private Parts as 1997.
Yeah.
My Best Friend's Wedding was also 1997. He's Bellman. Also in 97, Donnie Brasco. He's FBI technician. You know, there's just a bunch of these. Extras Guild researcher in Mighty Aphrodite back in 1995.
Yeah.
He is Kissing Man in Singles in 1992. You know, his original credit, the one on IMDb, 1990, TV movie, She'll Take Romance. He's Heckler Number Two. So, it's definitely, you see that progression. He starts getting names every once in a while, sometimes just a first name. And then eventually, it's always names. You know, you switch to always having those names and you're always carrying films on your own or being the lead.
Your agent gives you a call. How would you like to be Heckler Number Two? Not Number One. Number Two. You're number desperate. Number Two.
That's right.
Take it. Awesome. Yeah, apparently he, you know, I guess as most actors and actresses do, had a background in, you know, doing theater type stuff in school. And my guess, based on what we just talked about with him having supporting roles, is that it was just a true grind just to kind of work his way up. So impressive.
Yeah, so apparently his mother was an actress. His brother, he has a brother that's older, an older brother that's an actor as well. Who's not nearly so successful as he is. I looked up his credits. His name is Marcus Giamatti. He's pretty much only ever done television, and it's mostly guest appearances. I gotta look this guy up. Though he is getting, I guess, a major part in the upcoming TV series. They're doing a different Bosch series. Have you seen Bosch or heard of Bosch? It's a on Amazon Prime. It's one of the shows that they've had, and it's been fairly successful. It's gone through like 4 seasons, so it's pretty successful for Bosch. An Amazon Prime show. They're making one called Bosch Legacy. I don't know. It's a spinoff or... Anyways, he's got credits in the first 5 episodes out of I don't know how many, which could be all of them potentially. So he's also, yeah, done some other things, you know, single episode appearances on The X-Files or CSI. And he was on a soap opera for a while. So
it'd be cool to take a look at something he's in just to compare him to his brother. It's fun to look at like sibling acting similarities and differences. There's that whole thing with James Franco's brother who randomly has starred in a couple of films recently where I was like, why does this guy look familiar to me? And it literally it came to my mind like, oh, he looks like James Franco. And then I looked it up and it's like, ah, he's the brother of James Franco. Yeah, it was a weird moment.
Dave Franco is an odd...
Yeah, Dave Franco. Yeah.
We're not here to talk about Dave Franco, but now I'm thinking about Dave Franco.
Yeah.
He's an interesting guy in his own right.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. I'm not talking about Dave Franco. But yeah, Giamatti's. The other fun fact about Paul Giamatti and his family that I guess is the only other thing that I really know or could speak to in any way intelligently is that his father is Bart Giamatti, or was, I think maybe, was Bart Giamatti. He died a number of years ago, in the late 80s, I think. He was the commissioner of baseball for a brief period of time. Famously, he was the one who banned Pete Rose from baseball.
I think I saw this online, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I knew who Bart Giamatti was long before I knew who Paul Giamatti was, because I'm a baseball nut and I follow baseball, and, you know, the banning of Pete Rose is obviously one of the most significant things that's happened in the last 40 or 50 years in baseball.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was an interesting kind of factoid. I mean, his father apparently was a professor at Yale as well, and just an interesting family all the way around. You know, his father's commissioner of baseball and the Pete Rose connection.
Sounds like they weren't doing too bad for themselves. That's for sure.
No. Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
I know Paul went to Yale too, so yeah.
It's probably a lot easier if your father's a professor.
That's true.
Regardless of any other sort of consideration.
Yeah,
yeah. Cool. Well, I mean, we talked a little bit about his career. We talked about, you know, kind of the shape of it. Do you have any notion of what the first movie you saw Paul Giamatti in was? Or maybe a better question is, what was the first time he was really came to your attention in film?
I quickly mentioned earlier that the earliest recollection I have of him on screen is Saving Private Ryan as that Sergeant William Hill character. So I remember him being kind of bitter, feisty in that role. I believe they encounter him. Tom Hanks and crew encounter him as they're already sort of deployed and are on their mission to find Ryan. And he's a sergeant who's just out in the field randomly with troops, completely disorganized, doesn't know what's going on type of thing.
Yeah, they run into him. He's one of the, I think, one of the airborne guys that they first encounter when they go out into it's a town. They meet him on the outskirts of a town. And it's right before the big moment with Vin Diesel and that kid. So... So Saving Private Ryan. Did you really pay attention to him, though, as an actor at that point? Was that something that struck your attention, that role?
No, it didn't. It only strikes my attention now as I think back to that scene and the way he behaves in that scene. It so accurately epitomizes the types of characters he would go on to play. But there was no way, like, watching that scene in that moment, I was like, ah, Paul Giamatti, like, this guy's going to be a lead actor in some movies down the road, right? It was just this is a quirky character, an idiosyncratic character, right? But as you look back now, and we'll chat more about what his acting style is here in a minute, I'm sure, like, it makes a lot of sense that maybe some directors or folks saw that scene and they're like, oh, this guy has some kind of weird, eclectic energy to him, right? That might make sense in some quirkier type roles.
Yeah, I don't remember if we talked about this on the podcast when we were doing... when we talked about Saving Private Ryan, but a lot of the characters, no, that's the wrong way to say it. A lot of the actors that Steven Spielberg cast were chosen because they were not well known. And so you don't get the same feeling of the film watching it now that one did if you watched it when it was first in theaters.
Right.
Matt Damon was actually really well known when the movie came out as a consequence of Saving Private Ryan coming out just after Good Will Hunting.
Right. Yeah.
So Good Will Hunting was what pushed Matt Damon into the public eye. But before that, he was not well known, and he was cast in part because he was not well known. Mm-hmm. So guys like Ed Burns and Barry Pepper, Vin Diesel is in this, and Giovanni Ribisi. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of these guys, Paul Giamatti, were cast because they were not big-name actors. They were competent, talented actors. Dennis Farina's in this.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't want you to be caught up in who that actor was, which is why seeing Bryan Cranston now takes you out of the film when he's like the one-armed colonel that, you know, first, you know, one of the first people to discover this whole thing with the Ryan brothers.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting.
At the time, it was not Bryan Cranston. It was just some actor, right? He wasn't Walter White. He had no fame. And so you can't watch that movie anymore if you're familiar with media and get the same sense of what it was like to watch it originally, mm-hmm. you know, for the first time. Paul Giamatti falls into that category.
That's a weird phenomenon maybe we should explore at some point, is like when an actor's real life presence, history, and pedigree makes something completely like interpreted differently as you look in the past at a role. That's weird. Because you're right, the Bryan Cranston thing, like I'm thinking of that scene, and I actually saw that movie again this last year, and I was like, oh, it's Bryan Cranston. And it distracts you from the nature of this is a military officer just doing their duty type of thing. You're trying to read into it more because you associate things and memories with the character.
Yeah. There's supposed to be that moment where you're like, okay, is this actually Private Ryan? Oh, it's the wrong guy. But now people watch that and they're like, hey, it's Nathan Fillion from Firefly, you know?
Yeah.
He's totally not who that was when the film was first made. You're supposed to only have that with very specific people, right?
Yeah.
Tom Hanks was supposed to be well known. Probably Tom Sizemore to a degree as his sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Danson, maybe, who comes up in one of the towns. But beyond that, it was supposed to be a lot of relatively unknown actors. Mm-hmm. And Paul Giamatti was still at that time. Relatively unknown actor, yeah.
Yeah, and Saving Private Ryan, what year is that? Is that like 1999?
98.
So, I mean, his career, I guess you could say, blossomed relatively late. He's what, close to 60 now? That was 98. So, happened in his mid-30s is when he's really actually kind of caught fire.
Yeah. Sideways, I mean, which I would argue is still kind of that big movie for him. What was it, 2004? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So at that point, he was
like 40, 67. Almost. Yeah.
So 37?
Yeah.
36, 37 years old?
Yeah. It's pretty
which
late.
Is relatively late. Yeah. If you're going to catch on, most people do it a lot sooner than that. Though, I mean, it's not completely unknown. Liam Neeson probably had his big breakout in his 50s.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
You know, it's the exception, really, rather than the rule.
So earlier, I'm going to drive at you on this one. You mentioned some disadvantages. What would you say are his disadvantages? I have some in mind, but I'm sure, go for it.
He's a pudgy, balding, kind of average-looking dude.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I have two out of three of those myself. I'm not in any position to point fingers.
I mean,
listener guess which one I don't have, but, you know.
I'll be a little more mean, and I'll go on the record here. I'd say he's not as good looking as the average dude. I'll actually throw that out there.
I think he is pretty good for the average guy.
You think so? Okay.
In his 40s or his 50s. Because we got to remember that by the time you get to your 40s or your 50s, speaking as a man in his 40s, you're not what you were in your 20s. You're really not.
Yeah.
And these are just, we can't all be Tom Cruise and pay however many millions he pays to get himself looking the way he looks with trainers and dietitians and goodness only knows what.
It doesn't help with if you're also like Paul Giamatti and you're perennially just like not in amazing shape, you know, like you've decided that that's just, you know, that's your look. Like, I'm not going to be like super, super fit, that type of actor. Not going to be like way into my image. This is just like who I am. It's so not being super Hollywood attractive and then also not being a gym nut, you know.
Well,
it's just kind of a thing.
He comes from the era before that was actually necessary in an actor. So it did not used to be necessary to be remarkably physically fit to be in film.
Yeah.
That is a phenomenon in the last 20 years. I would say, is a little bit string. I would say social media and superhero films have done that.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Where you have everybody on social media and that has driven this kind of feedback loop for this kind of culture about, you know, looking a certain way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Perfection in one's appearance. But then also with superhero films being the biggest money makers, the superheroes in comics have always been drawn in these ridiculous ways. It'd be ridiculously muscular in ways that are probably
proportions. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's jokes you can find where people will diagram like a drawing from a comic of a superhero where they're like, this is a muscle group that doesn't exist in real life. They've just drawn extra muscles in this part of his body. Or,
yeah.
You know, whatever.
Yeah.
And that's always been a thing. So having been basically in his 40s when that trend hits, what are you going to do? Are you going to go from
just
having
like,
always just been,
is.
You know?
Yeah.
Not to in any way seem critical, just simply trying to be factual, kind of a schlub. To being, you know, like Superman? Nah, it's just not going
to
be you.
I don't think we're being overly critical. I think this is itself critical to the discussion, right? Because the types of roles he gets and plays, like, you know, he's not going to be billed as Superman. It's not going to be billed as Batman. It's just not going to happen. And so even as I think about him, you know, starting to break onto the scene in his 30s, like, maybe that makes sense in the fact that as a younger guy, is he going to be the younger guy selected for a more leading role? Maybe not, you know, maybe they want someone who's a little quicker, a little flashier, a little, you know, maybe taller. I don't know. So maybe it makes sense that he broke out a little bit later in his career where he's able to take on a bit more retrospective, kind of mature characters where that focus doesn't need to be on their, you know, moxie kind of charisma. Yeah.
Yeah. He is not someone who is going to be, even in the older mold, right, where you didn't have to maybe be tremendously physically fit. He was never going to be Cary Grant.
Yeah.
Right. He's not going to be Jimmy Stewart. He's not going to be the leading man with that leading man look.
Mm-hmm.
He was always much more of a character actor who could portray certain kinds of characters with either nuance or as an archetype, depending on what the role is calling for.
Yeah.
Because he will lean right into that stereotype if he needs to.
Oh,
whatever that role
yeah.
is. So, you know, he doesn't have to. I mean, we can talk about some of his roles where he doesn't, where he, you know, the nuance is there, but it doesn't have to be, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was your first exposure to him that you can remember?
Well, I know that I watched Saving Private Ryan in the theater in 1998. So I know I saw him then.
That must have been intense.
Know it was. I wasn't expecting it to be as intense as it was. And I was in college, right? So I'm a young guy, and I'm in this theater, and I'm crying because I was caught off guard.
Oh, that movie, yeah.
And so now I'm, like, embarrassed as well because I'm, like, 19, and, like, I shouldn't be crying in a movie. What's wrong with me? You know, it just didn't fit with my own macho self-image. But I didn't pay any attention to Paul Giamatti. I mean, I know I saw him. I mean, but I didn't pay any attention. I probably remember him actually better from The Truman Show.
Okay.
Which was the same year. Even though his part is in some ways less significant, he's actually on screen a lot more. And he plays a more significant role in a critical, pivotal moment of the plot among a much smaller cast.
Yeah.
And so he's the control room director in The Truman Show, one of the guys that eventually at the end of the movie, he's like, I'm not going to do this anymore. And he folds his arms at the evil director guy. But that was probably the first time I really remember seeing him and remembering him as an actor. I saw Donnie Brasco in it's out in 97. Have I seen any of these other movies that he was in? I would have seen My Best Friend's Wedding in 1997.
Okay. Yep.
I think my girlfriend at the time made me watch that.
But for the record, I didn't want to watch it.
I don't like that movie. I would have remembered him as the bellman. I can't even now remember what his role was. Yeah.
So. These are small little parts. Yeah.
Yeah. So no, it would have been Truman Show, I think. But again, he didn't strike me as being like, oh, big things from this guy, you know, look out. His career's on the rise. It was not that at all. I think that moment came when I saw him in The Illusionist in 2006.
And that's even after some of his biggest movies, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some of these other ones in between. He's got a small bit in Paycheck with Ben Affleck, which, not a great film, but it's based on a Philip K. Dick story. I don't remember which story it was. It's not called Paycheck. I didn't see Sideways until just recently.
I didn't see
Cinderella Man. No, it would have been The Illusionist, where I really noticed him as Inspector Uhl. And that's one of my favorite films. I love that movie.
I love that film. Yep.
And he's fantastic in that role.
Yeah, he is good.
Yeah. Yeah, did you see was it one of those? Was it Cinderella? Maybe Lady in the Water? Which one was the one where maybe you first took notice in a significant way?
You know, Illusionist is probably there, but I don't know. Back when I saw The Illusionist, I wasn't necessarily focusing on his performance as much as I was just enthralled by the fact that I love the movie in general. The whole movie's really cool. You know, it's probably Sideways for me because, you know, several years back when I really got into wine and I watched that movie, and don't need to give a recounting of what this movie's about too much because we just talked about it last week.
We just talked about it, yeah.
Yeah, is, you know, I was like, oh, okay, he's the main actor for this entire movie. And, you know, in watching that and being into wine, and that brought all the connections in place for me of other places I'd seen him, other films that he'd been in that I'd noticed him in. But really, that was where the connection really clicked for me, was watching a starring role film with him that also connected to my hobbies to really pull the interest together.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. That makes sense. With The Illusionist, it was, maybe we've talked about this on the podcast or not, I don't know. The Illusionist, I really liked his character because, in part, when I watch movies, I a lot of the time don't want to identify with the main character in some ways. So in that one, the Illusionist himself, Edward Norton, is the hero, right? He's the protagonist, the man who is driving the action. He is the immensely talented illusionist, the magician.
Mm-hmm.
He's in love with the beautiful girl, Jessica Biel, I believe it was.
Yep.
And he has the villain, Rufus Sewell, who is his antagonist. And while there is some truth to the idea that we're all the hero in the story of our own lives, right? That we imagine or think about our own lives as a novel in which we are the protagonist and moving through it. It's also never been me in real life. Like, I've never been like the star athlete or the smartest kid in the room at school getting the straight A's and the 4.0. And I've never been the guy at the pinnacle. That's not me. And I don't know that I've ever had the ambition to be that person either, most of the time. But what I often find myself doing is being like the best friend of that guy, or knowing that guy, or being supportive. Like, I'm the guy who's the guy behind the guy, in a sense, a lot of the time, which is exactly who Inspector Uhl is, right? He is not the smartest guy, But he is there to do his job and to do it well, and he has this loyalty to the, you know, certain things, and he has a code, and I really identified with his character in that movie, even though mm-hmm. he's not really the focus of that movie in a lot of
right,
ways.
Right.
He's important, but and so that character is super appealing to me.
Really? Strong, oh, yeah. principled character, yeah.
Yeah. And again, it was just he does it both it's a little hammy. Right, he does the accent, and mm-hmm. it's a little over the top. Like he's a little bit over the top, but then you have that scene where he invites Edward Norton in to the diner, while it's closed, or the restaurant, and he's eating, and he offers him something. He's like, no, and he says, "I'm going to ask you a question," mm-hmm. and it's going to seem like it's an unfriendly question, but I assure you, it is not an unfriendly question. And then he asks him about what his relationship is with the, you know, the woman, mm-hmm. Jessica Biel, and he's like, you know, you're right, that doesn't seem like a very friendly question. And he's like, that's exactly my point. And the way he does that was just, I enjoyed it. It was amusing. I thought, you know, if I was actually a cool guy who said things like they were written for me, but off the top of my head, mm-hmm. like that's how I'd want to do it, you know. And you know, we're never that cool in real life. We always stumble over our words. You just have to listen back to this podcast, even though I edit a lot of our
well.
Out of there. I edit that stuff out whenever I can. It's clearly I'm still not that smooth, and I've mm-hmm. never been that smooth. I'll never be that smooth. But wouldn't it be glorious?
Wouldn't yeah. it be glorious? I love that scene is meaningful to you. That's cool. It's also like not, I mean, it has flashes of the Paul Giamatti character type. But I wouldn't yeah. say it's like yeah. his most typecast of roles, you know?
No, it's yeah. it's not. He does, I guess maybe he's most strongly associated with that supporting role, both within mm-hmm. the film, but then also the character within the film. He's not the director in The Truman Show. He's the guy who runs the control room for the director. He is not right. the prince. He is the chief inspector who is working for the prince and the illusionist. Mm-hmm. And that is often his part in a lot of the movies that he's in. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I feel like his character typecast role can often be described as like socially embittered man seeking vindication type of thing.
Interesting. What do you mean by that? Socially embittered.
So I can pick a character example and then reference other examples.
Please.
So if it's American Splendor, which is one of the films I watched in preparation for this, I think his first like big leading role film, I think the year on that is what, 2001? Let's see here.
2003.
Okay. So this is like a, you know, drama biopic here. It's him playing Harvey Pekar, who was a comic book writer based in Cleveland, Ohio. And it's Paul Giamatti playing that man, you know, living his life story with flashes to actual real life Harvey Pekar, actually narrating some of the life of the film as it progresses. And that's obviously kind of like a, not a double entendre, but a reference to the fact that Harvey Pekar is a comic book writer and Paul Giamatti is playing him almost in a comic that he's narrating, whatever. Mm-hmm. That's beside the point. But the character of Harvey Pekar and Harvey Pekar, the man in real life, is an irritable, frustrated, bitter person who struggled for a long time to find their meaning in life, to eventually learn that, oh, I'm good at writing comics about real people's everyday lives. And so Paul Giamatti plays them in this movie accurately to what the man is actually like in real life as that embittered character who's looking for validation of his own sort of place in the world type of thing. So that's a good example of a film where he does that. In Sideways, another socially embittered role where he's a man who's recently got divorced. His writing hasn't received the kind of attention that he'd like it to. He's lost, right? He's going on this trip to Santa Barbara in a sense to celebrate his friend, but also in a way to lose himself in distractions that make him not have to think about how he doesn't actually like his life or where it's going. I could keep going. There's lots. There's Billions on TV where, although he's a very successful U.S. prosecuting attorney, he isn't given the same sort of visibility or respect that, you know, high earning big fish on Wall Street get, or even his wife gets who works for those folks. His dad actually has more spotlight than he does in his career, so he feels like he has to validate himself by being extra aggressive. So Paul Giamatti, to me, plays these roles where he's an angry, embittered, frustrated, sometimes softer than that, not always angry, but someone who feels like they're fighting back a little bit with society to get what they think they deserve.
Interesting. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. I think I haven't seen as many of those movies. I've seen Sideways. I don't know that I've seen... I haven't seen Billions. I haven't seen the one you just referenced, American Splendor.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess I see him playing more two other roles, which is the one I kind of described with Inspector Uhl, right? Where he is only the support to the greater character, right? To the greater man. And then also where he plays the man with the delusions of grandeur, who thinks that he is greater than he really is.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that it is a remarkably bad film. Shoot 'em Up, where he is the villain.
I haven't seen it.
It's not worth watching. It's despite the fact that it has Paul Giamatti and Clive Owen.
Yeah.
It is not worth watching. There's also Duplicity, which is worth watching. Interestingly enough, also has Clive Owen, Julie Roberts, Tom Wilkinson is in it. It's a really good movie. It's a good spy film. Got some good lines and fun, twisty kind of plot. There's, what else is he in? Probably Ironclad, where he plays King John.
Totally different role. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, it's more of the false belief in the degree of competency and capability that he has.
Yeah. He plays the first type of the two you mentioned in Cinderella Man. So, supporting character.
Right.
Who's utterly good-willed at his core, but promoting and being an advocate, a healthy advocate for a main leading character in an inspirable way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, not only does he play that supporting character role in films, that support character is who he plays in the films in a lot of cases. Yeah. Yeah. I guess there's other ones where he just simply chews the scenery in a really big way. I don't know if you've seen, I just watched Jungle Cruise.
I haven't seen that.
Not a great movie, but he plays, I guess he's supposed to be Italian. And he's there at this...
Well, he is Italian.
...town in the Amazon. Yeah, but not like...
No, I know what you mean.
Yeah, it's more like the Mario, you know, Super Mario Brothers Italian accent, Italian, you know.
Right,
it's
right.
It's me, Paul Giamatti, you know.
He's Giamatti, not Giagrotti, you know what I mean? Oh,
it's just over the top. Over the top. And yeah. He's not in it much. He's in it a little at the beginning, a little at the end. But it just leans into that everything stereotypical Italian. And it's...
Not good.
It's kind of terrible.
Yeah.
But he knows. I think he knows that about the role. And this is the other thing. Segues neatly. I don't think he cares. I think he is like a number of other actors that I'm fond of who are not maybe A-list actors. They're a cut below. They're second-tier actors. And I would say Paul Giamatti. I would say Brian Cox. I would actually say Liam Neeson falls into this category as well. Who else would I say? At this stage in his career, Bruce Willis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where they are not about the artisticness of every single movie they're in. They're here to do a film. It's work. This is my job. I'm getting paid. I need to do the work because I need... Working is the right thing to do. And I think that's why it's so hard to be so well-versed in Paul Giamatti's films. He has made a total of 76 films. There are several in production, but 76 released feature films. That date from 1991. So at the very beginning, again, he's very barely in these, you know, small parts.
Mm-hmm.
But he's made almost 50 in the last 15 years.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. He made, so we just take a few of these years. There were three of them in 2021, despite the pandemic. There was a bit of a break in there, I think probably because he was working on Billions. Mm-hmm. There were four in 2018, two in 2016, one, two, three, four, five in 2015,
mm-hmm.
one, two, three, four in 2014, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight in 2013.
Yeah.
I mean, the man works. And they're not all big parts, and they're not all great films, right? He did a voice for an animated film called Turbo, which mm-hmm. I'm only familiar with because my sons watch it, and it is just mind-bendingly awful.
Oh.
It is so bad. They must have paid all these people in it a mint in order to get them to lend their voices to it.
Mm-hmm.
Or they just did one take and they let them go because the number of names they have of people playing roles in this is so big and it is so bad.
Yeah.
It is difficult to express. But I think that he doesn't care so much about that. He's there to do a movie. He's there to say his lines. He's there to do the job that he is asked to do. And I find that admirable, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
It's at least as admirable as those people that are, you know, no, I'm sorry, this is my art. You can't, you know, no one could see me do that except you. I'm putting my hand in my forehead.
Yeah.
And I'm
yeah.
eating my fainting couch.
Like Daniel Day-Lewis.
Like Daniel Day-Lewis, who only does a very few films, and they all have to be exquisite, and he has to have the most perfect role, and it has to be thoroughly researched. And
mm-hmm.
I like the Giamatti attitude more, and I think it's at least as admirable.
I think it's especially admirable as more of a B-list actor, right? Because if you're an A-list actor, if you're kind of like Tom Cruise, who is certainly super hardworking alpha human, as we've talked about, you know, he's just having great roles thrown at him, right? It's any movie that can get him cast is going to want him cast. But if you're more B-list and you don't have as many options, but you're still willing to work hard and kind of put the grind in and do a good job as much as you can across films that probably aren't going to see most of the light of the day, it's a bit more impressive.
Yeah, but I don't disagree. Tom Cruise is in a position where he's turning down roles.
Oh, yeah.
He picks and chooses.
Yeah.
Maybe not always wisely or well, but he's definitely picking and choosing. But I think we mentioned him earlier, James Franco
mm-hmm.
is a B-level actor who wants to have the attitude of the A-level actor.
Right, yeah. That's a good call.
That he thinks that what I'm doing is art
mm-hmm.
with a capital A, and that he ought to be able to pick and choose these roles, and that they all have to be invested with serious purpose or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, man, sometimes you just need to go up, hit your mark, say your line, and go home.
Yeah, hit your mark.
And that's got to be good enough. It needs to be good enough.
I love that. I think this is interesting. I stand by my point that I think when Paul Giamatti is in a leading role, I see this consistent thread of character identity. So maybe I need to have you watch American Splendor. Have you seen Win-Win? This is a slightly different.
I haven't, no.
So Win-Win, he's not as embittered, I would say, or, you know, socially spicy, but he's a lawyer who's down on his luck in a small town.
I've heard of this. Is it the one where he's the wrestling coach?
Exactly. He's a down on his luck lawyer who volunteers as a wrestling coach for extra cash because he can't make any. And he eventually gets a rich client that he offers to be the custodian of in order to just make money off of that person paying him, you know, so that he can put them in like a retirement facility and just kind of make easy cash off of it. But then the grandson of that guy that he's taking care of ends up being a really talented wrestler that runs away and comes and joins his school. And so it's called Win-Win because it's like, oh, I'm making money off this kid's grandpa and he's also a really good wrestler. But then everything kind of slides downhill like dominoes, right? When things go wrong. So that's a slightly different leading role approach where he's not as angry or embittered, but it goes back to just sort of like the, it's not that he's necessarily a social outcast, but he's socially denied, right? He's not quite validated in his pursuits. And sure. I think that rings true across a lot of his roles. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it could well be. I was trying to count up. I was listening, but I was also trying to figure out how many of his movies I've seen. And it's a lot fewer than I guess it maybe ought to be. Mm. I had not realized before we decided on this topic how many movies he had been in. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, I didn't realize how many movies of his I had not seen.
Right.
Though there are enough of them, even in the recent times, that it would be difficult to say... enough of them in recent times where he is not the main character that it would be difficult to say, oh, is it important that you've seen that film to understand, you know, his role?
Oh, yeah.
Or his talent mm-hmm. in some way. For example, what's a good example of this? There's an animated film, Ernest and Celestine. It was French. He did a voice in the English translation, the English dub of it, which I've seen. It's a magnificent film. But it's a minor part. He's got like five lines.
That's really small.
It's yeah. really small. And they got him because it's a voiceover. And how hard is that? Like he, mm-hmm. it was probably, you know, 2 hours of work for him on a yeah. Saturday. And,
yeah.
you know, it's a decent paycheck. But as well, like, he's in the movie John Dies at the End, which is the same year, which I just watched. And again, he's in it for about 10 lines, and I looked up the trivia on it, and he basically did all his scenes in a day and a half or something, because he's not really in the body of the movie. He's basically the character that the main character is recounting the story of the movie to.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's basically just got to sit in this booth at a Chinese restaurant and occasionally say things about, you know, how ridiculous that sounds, or wait a minute, I don't understand, or, you know, that's really about all there is to it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was going to have a bigger role. I don't know that I gained any deep knowledge about his career from having seen him in that movie. So
Yeah. Looking
at these other ones that are on this list that I haven't seen, like, I know he plays a big part in Straight Outta Compton, but I'm not even sure how big a part he has in, say, San Andreas, right? That action film about an earthquake that The Rock stars in. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Maybe it's enough to make it worthwhile. Maybe it's not.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how I would know.
Yeah. No, I think most of them are fairly minor. I mean, The Illusionist is a standout where it's a supporting role, but it actually has teeth to it. Cinderella Man, another example. But as you walk through kind of that other filmography list, they're smaller. And like you said, it's hard to know on the surface. Oh, I'm a huge Paul Giamatti fan. Should I watch this? You probably need to have another Paul Giamatti expert tell you if it's more than a couple lines, right? If it's right. kind of like worth watching. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was in that position with John Dies at the End. I have a few more movies downstairs that I'm thinking about. Mm-hmm. The Catcher Was a Spy. I have Love and Mercy. I have Cinderella Man, which I know he has got a bigger part in, but
mm-hmm.
you know, not all of these. I just don't know.
Yeah. I can tell you that because I've seen the first season, that he's absolutely fantastic in Billions. Like, he really kills that role. And it's the perfect role for him. I mean, because he's not an action star. We've talked about this. He's not he's not flashy in that way. He's not seducing anyone on screen, or, you know, being like a love interest that people are going to go to the movies to see. What he is in Billions, which is a TV show, is he's a U.S. prosecutor, a lawyer, who wants to bring down big fish on Wall Street. And so he's able to be this angry, ferocious, but highly intellectual-driven person and do it in a really compelling way. Like, it's a great role for him. So he absolutely destroys that. His character has some weird traits that you probably wouldn't be a fan of. One being that he's like a sadomasochist in the TV show, which is weird. But his other scenes where he's just in his actual corporate role are really really impressive.
That one is the show was on Showtime or HBO?
Yeah, I think Showtime.
I feel like a lot of the time, movies or TV shows really, that are on prestige media channels, Showtime, HBO, Amazon, mm-hmm. whatever, will dial up some element of the language, sex, or violence to 11 just because they kind of can,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, no one's going to stop them. There's no rating that they have to achieve in order to make sure that their movie gets released widely enough.
Right. If it's like HBO, they're like, we do this because that's how you know it's HBO. Like, we're allowed to do this.
Yeah. I watched the new Jack Reacher series on Amazon, and mm-hmm. that was definitely falls into that category with the violence and everything. It was like, you didn't have to show me that. Like, I didn't want to see that.
Ugh, that show is so hard to believe. I could rant for a while about that, but
yeah, maybe we should talk about that another time. But there's no reason to drag this out any longer. I don't have a whole lot else that I really want to say about Paul Giamatti. I mean, mm-hmm. I think he's a great actor. I ought to watch more of these movies that he's in. I probably need to be a little careful about picking them because I don't want to watch another Jungle Cruise and get 5 minutes of Giamatti and 2 hours of nonsense that goes with it.
Yeah. You got to find some accurate fan page or someone who's done an in-depth, you know, better than what I'm doing or we're doing here. telling of his career and trust that voice, right? That's probably the way to go. Because, I mean, as you're saying, as we've been saying, it's just... some of these roles are so minor. It's, do I really pay $4, $5 to see 2 minutes of screen time for this actor? Or is what do I chew on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is then your favorite Giamatti part? Not necessarily your favorite movie that he was in, but your favorite part that he played.
That's a good question, and I'm trying to evaluate it in light of the films I watched just recently to prepare for this.
All right, you think about that. I'm going to go ahead and say, as no one will be surprised, it is definitely Inspector Uhl.
It's The Illusionist, yeah.
It is. It is The Illusionist. But it is not actually my favorite movie in which he appears. I actually like another movie a little bit better than that one, or two movies, in fact, better. I like Duplicity better as a film, I think, than The Illusionist.
Yeah.
As pleasing as The Illusionist is, Duplicity has enough twists and turns and enough varied characters in it that it really pleases me as a kind of spy film, a thriller film. It's a heist, almost a heist film in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another one that is not nearly so well known, I don't think. It is a small independent film that he was in called Cold Souls.
Mm-hmm.
It came out in 2009. Paul Giamatti is the star, and he plays himself. He plays Paul Giamatti, the actor. And he is putting on a production of a Chekhov play. I forget which one it was. But I think it's Cold Souls. That's why it's called that. Duh. He's putting on Vanya. Vanya, that's what it's called, Vanya. So he's putting this on. He doesn't feel like he's connecting with the part. And he doesn't feel like he's able to convey what he wants to convey, and he's getting in his own head and he's getting in his own way, and he's just really having struggles. So then here's the MacGuffin, here's the twist. He goes to this service that extracts his soul for him and puts it in a jar and stores it. And the guy that sells him on this service is like, people find that it's a lot easier to live their lives sometimes when they're not worried about dealing with having a soul.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever. And so he's like, oh, okay, this is great. So he does the play, but then it starts wrecking his personal life.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to get it back, and it's been stolen. And he wants to get another one, and he gets one that it's not his. And then things kind of spiral from there. And it's really an interesting film that thinks in interesting ways about what does it mean to have a soul, and what is it... you know, the sort of thing that could be interchangeable, and is it the sort of thing that could have physical, you know, physicality? Are we more than just the sum of who we are as people?
Yeah.
And I really liked it. It was really entertaining. It's not a fantastic IMDb, they give it 6.4, but I just thought it was fantastic. He does really, really well in this movie, and I was entranced.
That's a super interesting plot. I love that. Yeah.
If you're not into this whole sort of philosophical meditation on things in your movies, this is not for you. There are no car chases. I don't think there's any explosions.
If you're not an intellectual, you're not going to like this one. Well, I'm kidding.
To a degree, insofar as intellectual means someone who is inclined to sit and stare at their own belly button while they contemplate the meaning of their own life.
Thinking is hard for you. This is not your movie.
Stop putting words in my mouth. No. Sometimes you don't want to watch, a lot of people don't want to watch movies to have to be made to think. They want to go to be entertained or distracted.
Oh, that's fine. Totally. Yeah.
Perfectly cromulent, but this isn't the movie for you then. I think there might be one guy that gets shot, but it's not like it's an action film.
Right.
So anyway, though, Cold Souls. If you like Giamatti, if you like to do a little bit of thinking and you're not just there to be eating popcorn and shut your brain off for 2 hours, it might be the movie for you.
Yeah. For me, you know, I know you hate it, but I'd go with Sideways for me. I think it's an awesome leading role for him. I mean, he's this embittered guy who's really funny in lots of scenes. He's vulnerable in other scenes. He has a wide range of acting in the film and kind of runs the whole spectrum. And he's a highly believable representation of the character, I think. And it's obviously connected to my interests. So that's what I like watching him in the most. I think it's a good performance by him. So I go with that.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, I don't want to be critical. I don't know that we did him justice, but I enjoyed talking about it. And that is my bar for a successful podcast, since we're really making these just for ourselves. So as long as I enjoyed the conversation, victory.
Maybe we didn't give him a leading exposé, but certainly a supporting exposé, which is, you know, something that he seems well suited for. So I think we did great.
Very apropos.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us on this one. I want to do more kind of actor actress deep dives. So I think this is a concept we should continue to explore. So let us know if you like it too, because I think there's a lot of opportunity there. It allows us to branch outside of just a given year or a given genre, which is pretty fun.
Yeah, and you know, hopefully next time we can choose one where I've seen more than about 20-25% of the actor's total output before I hold forth and pontificate about their career and life.
Here's the thing about Paul Giamatti. My 25% knowledge of. Yeah.
Cool.
Alrighty. Well, we will catch you guys next time. Stay tuned for what our next topic will be. We'll let you know on social media, but thanks for tuning in.
Later.
Bye.